Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, Ashley here. Just a quick note to let you know this week's show is a re-release of one of my favourite shows from last year. Just around this time last year, I got together with five other women in a Greenwich Village apartment. We ordered Middle Eastern food, opened a couple of bottles of wine, and began to debate the newly released Sheryl Sandberg book, Lean In. As of today, that book has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 51 weeks. Leaning in has become a catchphrase, and Sheryl Sandberg's probably more famous for her views on women in the workplace than she is for her work at Facebook. Sandberg's views on what women need to do to get ahead remain controversial, but I'm glad she started what's turning into an international conversation. To date, this is the only show I've done in this format. It was really fun to make. I hope new listeners will get a kick out of it, and maybe long-time listeners may even want to delve into it again. Here's the show. Welcome to The Broad Experience, the show about women, the workplace, and success. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight. This week, a debate on Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In. The subtitle of the book is Women, Work, and the Will to Lead. And in it, Sandberg asks women to examine the internal obstacles that are holding them back from getting to the top. The book's topping the New York Times bestseller list in the US, and leaning in has become a catchphrase and a big topic of conversation among professional women. There were six women in this debate, including me. We were hosted by Dora Komiak, a longtime listener to the podcast, at her family's apartment in Greenwich Village in Manhattan. I'll let everyone introduce themselves.
I'm Stacey Marie Ishmael, and I work in technology and media.
I'm Yvonne Martin, and I work for an e-commerce company by day, and I'm a board member of a dance company by night.
I'm Dora Komiak, and I have an advisory firm that helps companies figure out what to do online.
I'm Gia Freireich, and I'm a relationship manager for a financial software company.
I'm Rebecca Jackson, and I'm a former investment banking professional turned startup consultant and advisor.
Before we plunge into the conversation, I should say that Princeton professor Anne-Marie Slaughter comes up in conversation a few times. She's the former State Department official who wrote an article last summer in The Atlantic entitled Why Women Still Can't Have It All. And her views on women and work are often mentioned as a counterpoint to Sandberg's because Slaughter focuses on the external obstacles women face in getting ahead, like gender bias and lousy childcare policies.
I mean, I thought I would just begin by asking people, because there was such a brouhaha about this book before it even was published, I wanted to just ask people to pitch in and say, what did you think of the book versus what you thought you knew about it before you read it?
Well, initially, I read the book before I read any of the reviews, and I found her very likable, and I liked the idea of promoting the idea of women in leadership, and I think she had great advice. I think it was after I read it, and I enjoyed it a lot, that I started also thinking maybe her audience was something that was very specific, and that there was a lot that wasn't really inclusive in some of the issues that people are facing right now, such as unemployment, and maybe, you know, you don't necessarily have all those choices.
I'll say that I went into the book with very negative expectations. I had read a lot. I had read Anne-Marie Slaughter's articles and a lot of other blog posts that just kind of ripped it to shreds and, you know, suggested that she was just coming from a privileged back, you know, point of view and, you know, didn't really have anything to say to the masses. But I felt completely the opposite after reading it, because I felt like it was just a positive message in as a whole. I didn't find anything that wasn't applicable to any woman that I knew, even despite the different ways you might interpret it or her specific circumstances. I feel like her message was attainable by all women or within reach.
Right.
I was one of those people who sent her 2010 TED Talk to absolutely everybody that I knew when it came out at the time. And, you know, I remember telling my friends, I really want to know what your perspective on this. I think it's really interesting. And so I felt like her book was a longer version of her TED Talk with some things that I found less sympathetic, partly because they were expanded. And one of the things I found less sympathetic was there are no voluntarily single people in her book. And there are no gay couples in her book. Everything about her book is calibrated around, here's how you're going to succeed in your marriage, in your family, and in your workplace. And those three things are sort of this inseparable triumvirate. And the one anecdote that she relayed about why single people need to get out is like, so I can meet a potential husband. I was like, really? I'm like, I just want to go to yoga class and not be judged for that. If you can pick up your kids after school, I can go to yoga class. Let's call that fair. And so I found that to be very challenging because it imposes a very specific way of thinking about what work-life balance and what success looks like in a way that I didn't personally feel was sufficiently inclusive.
I was amazed at how well written it was. And the thing that surprised me the most is that 25% of the book, and I know this because I read it on my Kindle, 25% of the book is footnotes.
Yes.
And the book is written by about a dozen people. So the book is a product, part of which is Sheryl Sandberg's photograph on the cover and her title and her contribution of several anecdotes and getting it together. But just like an organization requires lots of different people to contribute, lots of people contributed to this book.
And we'll come back to that idea of how much of Sandberg is actually in the book a bit later. Gia works in sales for a financial software company, and she says while she enjoyed the book, she thinks Sheryl Sandberg's position makes it tricky for her to understand the situations a lot of other working women face. She likes the emphasis Sandberg places on taking risks to get to the next stage of your career.
So it was very motivating, I think. It's something that I wish I had done more of earlier in my career, but I also think the reality is it's harder to do when you get to a certain point. Like, I'm in my 40s now, and I think that the reality is being a woman in your 40s in sales, you know, there's risk and then there's reality. And so there, I think that there's a lot of ageism in other areas, you know, that maybe, you know, she started a career from Ivy League schools and, you know, had done well for herself. And I'm someone who sort of transitioned my career midstream. I'm very, at this point, I think, hesitant to take risks.
She's probably not the only one. I agree with Gia on other fronts too.
In general, I enjoyed it. I thought, like you, that it was very well written, partly, I mean, mostly thanks to Nell Scovell, I'm sure, her co-writer. But the one thing that I did notice was not only does she, I almost feel like she bends over backwards to praise everyone. You know, she bends over backwards not to offend anyone, whether you're a stay-at-home mom or she tries to cover all her bases. I thought perhaps a little bit too much. It's like she doesn't want anyone to hate her. At least that's how it felt to me. I agree with you that there are risk factors for many of us that I feel that she's been able to ride above because of the trajectory that she's had and perhaps some of the other people that she knows who also seem to be in very high level positions. I mean, I got a lot out of the book, but I think that she's perhaps so up here that she maybe doesn't see some of the things that more normal people do have to face, boring little itty bitty things that don't fit neatly into the narrative all the time.
Yes. There are two people explicitly mentioned in this book who are not white. One is a Hispanic male and one is an African American male. And she uses them both as examples of people who sympathized with her when she was in an awkward situation, because they were used to either having somebody not like call on them when questions were asked or make fun of them in the office in a way that was inappropriate. And I thought, well, that's really interesting because she recognizes it when it's an African-American male and a Hispanic male and how them being different affects them. But she never talks about how non-white women have totally different experiences on top of everything that she's described.
She is writing something, though, that is, I think, generally right from her perspective. And we have to, I think, read it as such. Like, we'll read things through our own lens, but she's also writing through her own lens. And I think she's not saying this is the panacea, because I actually read some, you know, the police other articles where women were basically talking about, you know, well, how does this relate to a woman that's doing a far more kind of like blue collar kind of job? And I think if we start to look at this as to be the answer for everything, then we're trying to make it more than it actually is trying to be. And that's because we want that. And we're obviously trying to get to a bigger answer. But I think we have to be careful to sort of set it within, this is opening doors. It's starting a new conversation. It hopefully allows then those additional parts of the conversation that need to come out to the forefront to be part of that. And I think I get the feeling from the way she writes is, you know, yes, she to a degree is trying to please everyone, but at the same time, I think there's a level of humility in there that says, I don't know all the answers. Feel free to critique me and tell me where my gaps are. And I think that's what we have to do.
I don't disagree with that. I think the challenge that I have with Lean In is that it's a machine. It's an extremely well-oiled publicity machine. It's an extremely well-oiled series of events and circles, and it's dominating all of the conversation about everything. And so the fact is, in as much as we can say, but it's opening up the conversation for these other people, it's actually not. Because in as much as it's taking the conversation away from like the strident feminism of the 60s and 70s and 80s, it's now all about feminism means being very, very successful and getting to the C-suite. Like, those are, you know, that's the narrative that's being enabled by this in a lot of ways. And that's what I have a problem with.
I'm not so sure that's what the book is doing, or at least it didn't strike me that way. But this is one of those books that everyone reads from their very personal perspective.
But also, I mean, I feel that, because I'm not like you at all, Rebecca, I wasn't really ambitious at all when I was younger. I really didn't know what I wanted. I've had this very messy, quote, career trajectory. And I would say I'm more ambitious now, you know, in my early 40s than I was 6, 7, 8 years ago, when I was putting all my emphasis on a relationship and coasting a little bit on the job front, when I perhaps could have, looking back on it, exactly.
See, what's the word?
No, because I really, in hindsight, I realized after the relationship had ended and after the relationship with the employer had ended, that I could have been paying more attention perhaps and doing some of these things that I didn't. I was in that. Back then, I was typically female and British, and that I thought, you know, speaking up for myself was vulgar, and why should you need to do it when you were doing the work and it was clear that you were doing a good job? All this stuff, which is partly why I started doing this show. But I'm not this super, I'm not the super ambitious person who ever wanted the corner office or anything. I've always wanted to be happy and fulfilled in what I do, but I totally value my free time, even though I'm not married and I don't have kids. And yet I didn't feel like the book was putting me down in any way.
For Yvonne, it was the chapter that brought out the differences between men's and women's approaches to job applications that really struck her. Men will apply for a job even if they only have some of the qualifications required. Women feel they must have virtually all of them before they'll apply.
The fact that more women are afraid of being seen as a fraud, or the guilt that was sort of persistently brought up in the Sit at the Table chapter, that was probably part of the book that resonated the most deeply with me. Because I can't tell you how many countless jobs I've thought, oh, you know, at first I'm like, I could do that job. And then it's like, oh, well, no, well, they want this and they want this. And, you know, I'm not qualified. And if I show up there, I'm going to embarrass all women, you know, and no other woman's going to be able to get a job after, no black women for sure. Like, you know, like, oh, no, I'm going to close the door behind me if I, you know, can't answer every single question on this interview or whatever.
It wasn't long before we got onto a discussion about the chapter called Don't Leave Before You Leave. This is where Sandberg famously claims too many women switch off their ambition before they've ever got pregnant, or sometimes even have a partner, because they're thinking ahead about how they'll balance work and family. Rebecca was a hard-charging investment banker till she quit in 2011.
To a degree, that's partly what I've done. Like, I left banking because I was burned out, but I also had in the back of my mind, this is not what I want if I'm going to be a parent. And I could already see the guilt. I could already sort of, like, before even having a child, I could sense this is going to be painful in ways that I won't be able to deal with. And I don't think I'll be able to bear the thought of doing two things really sort of like badly, or at least that's how I felt. So I thought I need to leave now and figure out something else quick enough before, you know, one's eggs run out and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, is that leaning back? And then I read an interesting article that's a bit of a follow-up to this, saying that essentially before you lean in, make sure you're leaning into the right road. So it's not like going, just lean into everything, just regardless, just lean in like the Leaning Tower of Pisa and hope for the best. It's more like, what is it you actually want, and lean into that. And I think, and I hope that Cheryl would, you know, agree with me that my own personal sort of change has been lean into a different kind of career, but one that I feel where I might work the same level of hours, but my ability to be flexible around, you know, a life with children will potentially be greater. And that, you know, is something that I think definitely was a key part that really, really spoke to me.
And talking of kids, in our group, Dora was the only one who has them. She and her husband have twin girls who are 8. She felt Sandberg didn't say enough about how she manages her home life.
So it's sort of like the whole pregnancy chapter in here. You know, she tells her own story. She has all these researchers give all the stats. And at the end of the day, it's just, look, women deliver the kids. And men or partners, however you define them, need to be allowed to be partners and parents. And that's where I think we as a society need to work on, like, letting other people raise your children. Some of the best advice I ever got was, the more people love your child, the healthier your child will be. And that kind of context of, like, let other people in, you know, let your partner in to be a parent. Let your best friend from college who's single be an uncle, you know, just let him in. And I don't think we hear enough of that. So I wish she had talked a little bit more about that, because she's very closed on how her kids are actually raised.
That's true, actually. I hadn't thought about that.
She's very closed on, like, what are the details? How do you do it? Okay, it's nice that you sit down once a week with your husband and map out who's picking up the kids from school every day. Great piece of tactical advice.
But how many nannies does she have? Like, does she have one nanny? Does she have two? Right. Yeah. How does it work with relatives?
Right. And you need a lot of people. And you've always needed a lot of people. And I think that's the parenting thing that I wish she... I think she will, over the next 5 years, as her kids grow up, as she transitions from being COO of a public company to leading a social movement. I think, I predict... Here I am going on the record predicting that she'll talk more about the different kinds of people, that the different ways she's organized her staff or support network to do it. I wish she does, because it's not real any other way.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Can I just changing tack slightly, I want to pick up on something that Gia said, which was sort of talking about that authenticity at work aspect of the book. And I think that chapter is called, what's it called? Speaking Your Truth, I think. And I was just looking at that again today. And that's one of the chapters that struck me as slightly incongruous in that. Because I know, you know, Stacey and I should have talked about this before, because she talks about a couple of times when she cried at work, and then she goes on to say how it's essentially better to be this way, to be able to be your whole self. And this is just something that I spoke about in the latest show with Kathy Caprino. But I personally think this is another area where her, you know, quote, privilege comes about, because I think, okay, if Sheryl Sandberg wants to cry at work, even if at the time she wasn't CEO of Facebook, that's okay. But for a normal person, I don't know, what do you think?
So many times at work.
You were in a pretty stressful situation. But I mean,
in front of managers.
And it was okay?
I wouldn't go as far as to say it was okay, but I do recall crying when I was told about a management change decision affecting me, and that I think my bonus at the end of 1 year, having worked like I'd never worked in my life and got probably the best review I'd ever got. And then because the bank wasn't doing so well, the whole bonus situation was really disappointing. And I burst into tears. And over money. I know it's terrible. Why am I saying this publicly? But it was in front of my manager, who's a very senior guy. And I remember I said something to the effect of, I'm just going to cry now because this hurts. And, I need to sort of get my act together. And you're going to just let me cry, because if I do that, I'll be able to go back to my job, like my desk, and do my job. But I spent a lot of time actually talking to people about emotion being okay and emotion not being a disease. And part of that is because, happy to admit, I had a post-traumatic stress disorder in my 20s and a lot of sort of dealings with depression. So like emotion was just a strong part of just my everyday life. And I think that it is an important thing, and we can't deny it. And if we keep pretending that human beings are completely objective and trying to turn them into machines, we will all be replaced by machines much, much quicker than we ever realise. So I don't think it's easy to cry at work. I'm not saying it's necessarily the right thing to do in a situation, but I'm definitely a strong believer that, you know, if you are wired like me and you are an emotional person, it's better out than in sometimes.
But Stacey says the problem is all emotors are not created equal, or at least not viewed in the same light. It all depends on your status in the hierarchy.
Certain people can have emotions at work, whether those emotions are positive or negative. And I think the thing, Sheryl Sandberg isn't angry anywhere in this book. You know, going back to the earlier point about bending over absolutely backward to be compliant and easygoing and absolutely understanding and wonderful, never angry anywhere in the book. And I think, you know, woman being angry is a fraught issue, and one that she does not discuss. And women in authority sometimes have to be angry, sometimes have to be really, really pissed off, and sometimes have to hold people to account. And there are so many layers of complexity with, one, being a woman in a position of power, two, being a woman in a position of power who has to be angry with people, and how you phrase that. You know, if you're going into a meeting and you have to be smiling while you are absolutely furious, it does a little bit to kind of undermine the message that you're trying to tell. Or if you're trying to send an email that says, I don't approve of your behavior today, and you have to end it in a smiley face so that people don't think you're a bitch, it's just, you know, it's really complex. And I feel that, one, she's in a position where she probably doesn't have to be angry with people because she has people who can be angry with people on her behalf. Right. And two, she's been so senior for so long that it's easy for her to be comfortable with displaying these emotions in this context, because nobody's going to tell her that wasn't appropriate.
But Sandberg never gets angry in the book, because Sandberg's never in the book. It's a product, and she's an important part of the product, and she's a very powerful part of the product. But it's not her diary. Like, if you were to get a couple drinks in her and, like, ask her at 2 a.m., like, what do you really think? No. Like, this is not what you would hear. And that's okay, because that's not what this book is. This book is not a tell-all memoir of here's how I did it. This book is something that dislodges a stalemate of a conversation and moves it into something else. But she's not risking a ton by writing this book. Exactly. Exactly. She's not risking a ton by writing this book. And that's so, like, once you realize that, like, this is not my best friend Cheryl telling me what she thinks, there's some good stuff in there.
For Yvonne, one of the main nuggets of good stuff was the message that women need to be more confident, to doubt themselves less, and to care about claiming credit where credit is due.
You know, you hear about these titans of business who were known not necessarily for their, well, yes, they always had a certain genius about them in terms of strategy or negotiations or things like that, but they weren't always the best, you know, tactical executor. And I feel like women often get siloed into the workhorse of perfection, and we are going to carry the weight of this organization on our shoulders. We are going to make this happen, muscle it through. And who cares if we get the credit? It happened. We are happy to see it happen. We are not happy to toot our own horn and say, yeah, I did that. And all you, well,
women, she says, need to own it, to put their stamp on something and say, I did this and I'm proud of it. Dora says, yes, we do need to put a stake in the ground.
They got to be owning it, right? Women need to be owning it. But at the same time, I think we need to be celebrating guys who are not owning it. I mean, I had a big aha moment. Seriously, the guys who are leaning back, man, let's make some poster children out of these things. So my brother-in-law, classic, Anglo-Saxon white male soccer star, right, in sales. You know him. You know him. Nice guy. And he works from home 3 days a week. Has a little house cabana. And I'm like, okay, so Marsh, so, you know, what's going on? Like, what's your story? Oh, you know, I like to have dinner with the kids. I like to get them off to school. Wow. Poster boy, NCAA soccer goalie, hoo-ha, whatever. We got to put your face on the cover of, like, something.
Rebecca agrees that men who take on less traditional roles need more validation.
And I know many women and sort of peers of mine and people I work with who were the biggest earners in their partnership. And, you know, it's more normal. I think it's something now like 30% of women, I think she quotes in the book, out-earn their spouses or their significant other. And that's something that we have to find a way to get a good lexicon around to make guys feel good about that as well, because at the moment it becomes emasculating. Like, I know for sure that I would never have survived the last few years I was working in banking if it wasn't for my husband. Like, he was an incredible rock. Definitely is, you know what I mean, one of those people that does half and half, picks up the slack in the areas where I'm rubbish, such as paying bills on time and getting things filed and stuff. Like, I can do super organized in the office, but once I leave that environment, I am basically a one-woman SHIT show. So, you know, it's I really do believe that that's important, and we need to sort of elevate the role of those guys who are man enough in themselves to be able to play that kind of role and, you know, be an equal partner.
And on that note, that's The Broad Experience for this time. Thanks very much to my five guests on this week's show. You can let me know what you think of the show at thebroadexperience.com. We have a Facebook page, which you are most welcome to like, and I'm on Twitter at Ashley Milne-Type. That's all one word without the hyphen. It just gets too complicated. The Broad Experience is supported by the Mule Radio Syndicate. You can also help this one-woman production by kicking in a few bucks at the support page on thebroadexperience.com. And if you know someone who'd like the show, please spread the word. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.